couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Happy Death Day to You, Alita Battle Angel, Isn't It Romantic, and some of the best Valentine's Day weekend movies that you can watch. Because I know it's not Valentine's Day anymore. I mean, Valentine's Day was on Thursday, but you have the whole weekend to spend time with your main squeeze, so get those claws ready to move. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Plague of the Zombies. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to hit is a little bit of a callback to a couple weeks ago when I was talking about some of the weirdest things that happened to you in a movie theater. And this one comes from Jason from the Sample Chapter podcast. I was on his podcast late last year talking about some of my writing that you can get online at Amazon.com. And he wanted to tell us a story about one of the weird things he saw going on, and this story isn't as odd now because you can get alcohol in movie theaters and a lot of main movie theaters like AMC, whereas it used to be you just had to go like draft houses and that type of an establishment to get alcohol. But he was talking about how he was working in a Carmike Cinema back in Colorado, and somebody complained that a group was drinking wine in the theaters. Now, like I said, that was verboten back then, and it certainly is wrong and illegal to bring wine into a place, even if it has a liquor license. So he went there to check it out, and you'd expect it to be like teenagers, you know, sneaking in a bottle of wine in their coat. But he said, no, it was like six people well-dressed, and they had bottles of wine, but they also had like a basket with cheese and other snacks. I mean, they basically had a wine and cheese party in the movie. He doesn't remember exactly what movie it was, but it was for the Oscar run of movies. You know how they show the Best Picture nominees? They literally brought in wine and cheese into a movie theater and were eating it. But I found that to be really interesting because now you can get wine and I guess you can get cheese at a movie theater. So that's a great little story. The next piece of news is actually news from this week, and it's a little bit distressing for cinemaphiles like myself, and it is that the Oscars have decided to tinker again with the ceremony this year because they don't have a host, which you'd sit there and you'd think immediately, oh, well, that means without a host, that means there's more time for the regular Oscar stuff. But no, I guarantee you, without a host, it's just they're going to increase the number of song and dance things. This is what happened back when there was a writer's strike. And I remember talking to some friends of mine and they're like, well, won't it shorten the ceremony? I go, oh, no, no, no. They're going to have a whole bunch of production numbers. Hooray for Hollywood. Isn't movie grand? Blah, blah, blah. And all that fluff and garbage that nobody really cares about in the show. I mean, yeah, you're not going to have Ellen taking selfies and you're not going to have Jimmy Kimmel taking the stars over to another movie theater to throw t-shirts at the crowd with Gal Gadot or anything like that. No, you're going to get all this fluff. And in order to make room for that fluff, they have announced that they're taking four of the categories and they're just going to air them during commercial breaks and you can stream the winning of it online, but you're not going to see it. I guess they'll probably announce it when they come back. And the categories you'd think would be some bizarre category. No, these categories are cinematography, editing, the live action short film, and makeup and hairstyling. And honestly, I don't understand how any of those got bumped. I understand if you've got something like costumes versus makeup and hairstyling, and maybe if you find some way to consolidate them. But that's kind of, I think that's a minor award, but it's a significant award. And then cinematography, that's in charge of the look of the movie. How do you have movies without cinematography? And I understand your average person walking the street doesn't sit there and be like, oh, Bill Pope, he's a great cinematographer. You know, a lot of people don't recognize these people, but they're main movies, they're major movies, and it's important. And I think it's good for the education of people to watch that, to understand that it's not just the celebrities and stars. Same thing with editing. Editing is so important in movies. It really is. And then there's the short film. This is the passion. This is the labor of love. These short films, they have very little chance for advancement. They're just these passion projects that people do, and they're going to give the live action one out in the commercial breaks. This is just stupid. Shorten the freaking ceremony. Don't jerk the winners. Take out all the fluff and the garbage and the glitz and the glamour and announcers announcing announcers. Trim it down, but don't trim down the... That would be like having a football game and saying, you know, we want the Super Bowl to be shorter, so we're getting rid of the extra point. You do a touchdown, that's it, and that way we can move on, and you can't get that extra point or the two-point conversion. We're just getting rid of that. Because that's part of the football game. Get rid of the halftime show, or get rid of some of the timeouts, or get rid of all that fluff and the people running out on the field. The coin toss, don't air that. I mean, don't get rid of part of the football game. Don't get rid of part of the actual Oscar ceremony. It's stupid and it's short-sighted and proves Hollywood has no idea why people don't watch the Oscars anymore. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is one that comes out this summer, and it's a remake of a beloved movie of mine, and that is Child's Play, which opens on June 21st.
At Caslon, we believe that happiness is about more than entertainment. It's about being known, understood, loved. Introducing your new best friend.
Chucky?
I love the original Child's Play, and for the most part, I love the series. I think it has its ups and downs. It gets a little goofy after a while, and the new films that they've been making, you know, like Curse of Chucky, I enjoyed. But I do recognize that, you know, rebooting it into the big theaters, I think, is a good idea. I'm not wild about this sort of wireless remote type element that it is trying to make it too techy. It reminds me of like having a TV show that gets rebooted and say, we need to have the social media guru come in and talk to people. That kind of feels like that with this movie. Hopefully it just goes back to raw horror. I like Aubrey Plaza. I'm looking forward to seeing her in it, and I'm hoping for a legitimate horror movie. And at the very least, it looks like it's trying that. Jury's out. We'll see what happens in June. The next one, which caused a lot of buzz this week, Aladdin, opens on May 24th.
Bring me the lamp. Your life begins now. Aladdin.
You really don't know who I am. Genie, wishes, lamp, none of that ringing a bell.
Okay, now, the trailer for this one looks very similar to the first one, and you're like, oh, this looks kind of okay. Jafar's voice is a little goofy, and you're watching it, and you're like, oh, okay, oh, that's nice that they didn't whitewash the characters, and they actually got, you know, somebody who is, you know, an ethnic person to play Aladdin, but oh my God, what is that? And then suddenly the genie shows up, and it's Will Smith as the worst version. I honestly have seen fake Aladdin posters that were made like a year ago that look better than this. First of all, Smurfs are going to be all upset because of the blue face they're using in this trailer. But also, this just looks like an abomination at this point. Nobody is into this that I've heard. Everyone's just like, oh, this just doesn't look right. Part of it is Will Smith is stepping into Robin Williams' shoes, and these were huge shoes to fill. This was one of those roles you can't do again. You either become imitative and derivative, or you do something completely different and you crap all over it. And I think he's going to end up somewhere in the middle because he's kind of doing the Will Smith swagger thing. But as we know from seeing plenty of Will Smith movies, he's not as good as an improv guy as he thinks he is. And I have a feeling it's going to basically feel like when you get like a Dr. Seuss movie and you can tell where the Dr. Seuss words end and where the screenwriter's words end, where they don't understand exactly how to put together Seussian words. That's basically what you're getting here. This could be an absolute disaster if especially if this genie's in it for as much as he was in the original animated film. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the best Valentine's movies to watch this weekend.
Because we can! Uh-oh. 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 Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I am going to delay some of the reviews this week so far because I want to talk about Valentine's Day. And like I said in the beginning of the show, yes, I know Valentine's Day was on Thursday. I am aware. I own a calendar. I own a couple, actually. Thank you very much. But anytime you have a major holiday and Valentine's Day falls into that category, and it falls close enough to a weekend, it kind of absorbs a weekend. So even though it was on Thursday night, it's considered Valentine's Day weekend, which is kind of good for people who want to go out to dinner, because getting a table for on Valentine's Day is a disaster, and it's awful, and it's horrible. My wife and I, we never go out on Valentine's Day. We purposely don't do that, and we go like a week later when nobody's out. Although, I think the Valentine's Day meals are going to spread all the way, at least into Saturday night. But after the meal, if you lucked out and got tickets to Hamilton, you could be that cool boyfriend or girlfriend and take your significant other, or husband or wife, and take your significant other to see Hamilton or something fancy or schmoozy. But you know what? Sometimes we just want to come home and we want to snuggle. We want to Netflix and chill. And we want to snuggle and watch some movies. And I'm going to give you, because I am such a romantic beast and I am such a sexy beast, I want to pass that along to the listeners so they understand how to woo members of the opposite or the same sex. I do not judge here. You know, whoever you want to woo, I'm giving you ideas on how to woo people in. So these are my personal three favorite romantic movies. And the first one is a classic. You'll notice a trend. I think all of these actually are from the 80s, which shows how old I am. Because, you know, on Valentine's Day, if you're not going to date yourself, who's going to date you? So this is from the 80s. And it's a bit of a cross-genre one, but it is absolutely definitely a romance. And that is The Princess Bride.
I brought you a special present.
What is it? A book?
This is a special book.
I've got my country's 500th anniversary to plan, my wedding to arrange, my wife to murder. I'm swapped.
Jesus, Grandpa, what did you read me this thing for?
Well, who says life is fair? Fencing, fighting, chases, escapes, giants, monsters, torture. Revenge, true love.
This is one of those rare movies that is able to do multiple things. It's able to tell this beautiful love story. It's able to be a swashbuckling adventure. It's able to be a family movie. And it's also able to be a full-on comedy. It's one of those bizarre movies that hits the cinematic sweet spot and is kind of everything for everyone. To the point that it was even parodied in Once Upon a Deadpool late last year when they re-released that as a PG-13 version, because of course they got Fred Savage to sit in as himself in this sort of hyper-real version where Deadpool's telling him the story of Deadpool 2. This is one of those movies that a lot of times the people who end up watching it are dragged kicking and screaming to it. I remember my wife showed it to my kids, my older kids. I don't know if my youngest son has seen it yet, but she showed it to my older kids, and they're like, I want to watch that. I mean, they were literally sounded like Fred Savage at the beginning of it. Oh, I don't want to watch it. It's got kissing in it. I don't want to watch a princess movie. Ugh, Bride. It's got every Princess Bride is everything that a little boy doesn't want to see in a movie in its title. And then they watch it, and they absolutely love it. It's still one of the greatest love stories in the world, and because it's so pure. And, you know, yeah, if you think past the veneer of the characters, you sit there and say, well, the pirate, Dread Pirate Roberts, you know, Wesley did murder a lot of people in the past because he was just taking them. That's his job. It's his pirate. You know, you don't want to think about that. But it is such a charming movie, and it's sweet and it's lovable. And there's so many, you know, great characters in line. It's impeccably cast. It's one of those last vestiges of that grand type of movie in the 60s, which had this grand sweeping group of comedians in it. Stuff that Mel Brooks would be involved in or Sid Caesar. And it's kind of one of the last of its kind where it had all these famous comedians at the time, you know, like Billy Crystal had a little bit of a role in there. And of course, Christopher Guest, even though he wasn't a comedic role, he was in it. You had the Sicilian Inconceivable, you know, and you had Andre the Giant. I mean, it's the weirdest cast you've ever seen. And speaking of Child's Play from earlier, it's got Chris Sarandon, who was in the original Child's Play. He plays Humperdinck. And Robin Wright, it kind of put her on the map, took her out of Santa Barbara, the soap opera, put her on the map where she kind of languished until she finally did Forrest Gump. But yeah, The Princess Bride, absolutely worth seeing, and it's completely watchable. Men, women, children, anybody can watch it. Just don't date children. That's a bad idea. Let's move on to the next one, and that is another film, ironically, not just from the 80s, but directed by Rob Reiner, one of my favorite romances ever, When Harry Met Sally.
Men and women can't be friends, because no man can be friends with a woman that he finds attractive. He always wants to have sex with her.
So you're saying that a man can be friends with a woman he finds unattractive?
No, you pretty much want to nail him, too.
I need to talk.
What happened?
What's the matter?
Harry came over last night.
I went over to Sally's last night.
Because I was upset that Joe was getting married.
And one thing led to another.
And before I knew it, we were kissing,
and
then...
To make a long story short...
We did it.
They did it.
I'll have what she's having. I like to go to restaurants and just say that. Whenever somebody comes by, like, you know, I like to go on cruises. Of course, everybody's kind of in their own little world, and you go to the dining room and you see people laughing, and I'll go to the waiter. I'll have what she's having. I'll say it really loud and usually get kicked off the ship, and I gotta, you know, fly home from Jamaica or something like that. But anyways, When Harry Met Sally, it's directed by Rob Reiner, but it's written by Nora Ephron. And that's important because she became one of the strongest female writers and directors once she got into the 90s and she was able to direct her own stuff. And she kind of had her own brand, which was a little different than the Nancy Meyers brand that she was developing in the 80s and 90s as well. But Nora Ephron once described this, and I'm using her words, not mine, but she said there's Jewish love stories and there's Christian love stories. There's, you know, the Christian love story is boy meets girl, and then they have to go through obstacles to fall in love. And then the Jewish romances were about a boy and a girl are there, and they are getting in their own way of falling in love. And that's essentially what When Harry Met Sally is. And it's a great story. It breaks down relationships so perfectly because it shows the angst and the ups and the downs and where people have emotional stunting and how they get in their own way and how they have problems and how when your readiness is there, the other readiness isn't there, and how you can stumble into, you know, sexual relationships and maybe not have it be the right thing. It is such a great breakdown of relationships. It's unreal, and it's so wildly entertaining. So absolutely, When Harry Met Sally, again, something that I think men and women can both relate to. And then the final movie, one of the greatest romantic movies of all time. It is a movie that transcends time and space. It is a movie in which a man is so in love with a woman that he will go through anything, and any sacrifice, and he will leave everything he's ever known to travel to a different time and a different land. No, I am not talking about Outlander. I am talking about this film.
I'm here to help you. I'm Reese, DN38416, assigned to protect you. You've been targeted for termination.
Why does it want me? Why me?
Arnold Schwarzenegger is... the Terminator. Your future is in its hands.
That's right, the Terminator. We all forget this is a love story. My sister calls this one of her favorite love stories as well. She really connected with this in the 80s, you know, and she pointed that out. You hear Kyle Reese travels back in time for Sarah Connor. And oh yeah, there's a guy with a Terminator shooting up Los Angeles in the process, but that's the core of the story, is that love story. Because without that love story, you don't get John Connor to save the world. See? It wasn't Titanic. It was Terminator that James Cameron made the greatest love story ever. And that is it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Happy Death Day to You, and isn't it romantic?
Oh, oh, I love you so. Uh-huh. I can't let you go.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now we can jump in full-fledged, both feet into the fire for the movie reviews of the week. It's a weird week. And here's why. It's Valentine's Day week. And we got, with the exception of Valentine's Day next year, where it's going to fall on a Friday, Valentine's Day falling on a Thursday, as you can spread that through the whole weekend, and you would think there would be more date movies out there. And I guess What Men Want, which came out last week, could count as a date movie. But there's really only one date movie that's out this week, and we'll talk about that at the bottom end of this break. But the first one I want to talk about is Happy Death Day to You. When she is pulled back into a time loop, a college girl is sent into a parallel dimension where a new psycho is trying to kill her.
A day reset when you died, right?
Yeah.
I might be able to help with that. I died 11 times.
I was stuck reliving the same day over and over again until someone wearing a baby mask murdered me on the night of my birthday. I thought it ended the loop, but I'm back. Oh my God. Everything's different. This time, it's coming after all of us.
If you don't reset the day and try again, they're dead for good, aren't they?
So I'm gonna have to die over and over again to save all of you.
I remember when Happy Death Day came out, about a year and a half ago. It was in October, and it was one of those movies that it did well enough for a horror movie, for a Blumhouse movie that I think it had like a $5 million budget, and it made enough money to really kind of cause a splash. It didn't break $100 million or anything like that, but it was a significant enough movie. What I liked about it is it riffed off of the original slasher movies of the 80s. And it did so in a safe PG-13 manner, which I thought was pretty clever, by telling a really neat story, which is essentially Groundhog's Day in an 80s slasher environment. Every time she gets killed, she goes back to the beginning of her birthday. And a part of it's Jessica Ralph, who plays the lead character. She's charming and beautiful and sweet, and she totally still works as a college student, even though she's in her 30s. But she was a great kind of carrier for the whole story. And it just was a fun little movie that was pure as a slasher movie, but managed to do so without the gore and the breasts and everything that you need for a slasher movie from the 80s. And so I respected the fact that it was able to do a PG-13 version of a slasher movie without looking like it was trying to do a PG-13 version of a slasher movie. Because it had sort of a creative catch to it. You know, if you've watched Russian Doll, you know the kind of movie I'm talking about. And you get the time loop coming back. And it's actually closer to Russian Doll than Groundhog Day, because it's about the person dying and having to pop back on their birthday, no less. But Happy Death Day to You, of course, they're going to make a sequel because it was popular and they rushed it out. I mean, it's a year and a half later, which is they're almost working at the speed that they were doing slasher movie sequels back in the 80s as well, where they came out with one every year. This one is, it's clever enough. I mean, you're never going to get the freshness of the original, and that's going to be the case. That was the case with the Lego movie last week. You know, once you have something that kind of surprises people, you can't have something just as surprising. You have to accept that and move on. And I think they did. And what they did is they said, let's not retell the story. Let's give something different, but we got to throw a time loop in here. And in this sense, it kind of becomes more of a science fiction movie than a horror movie, which doesn't bother me because I like both science fiction and horror. I'm totally okay with that. But if you are a horror purist and you don't like sci-fi, you might be a little bored with the sci-fi elements, because it deals with a scientific explanation for why there's a time loop, and it kind of has a bit of a Big Bang Theory feel to it at a certain point where you got this team working on this device in the basement of the school. And it does at one time, there's one part in there where it does swerve a bit too much into absurd, silly comedy. And I think that's just because they're saying, hey, we're not taking this movie too seriously. Even the first one took itself a little more seriously and just sort of telling the story that it was going to tell. But you know what? I'm okay with that. I'm okay with, keeping it as grounded in that universe that it created as it can in order to tell a story that still works. And I thought it was compelling because it's, of course, her, in the story, she gets pulled back into a time loop because one of her other people who's involved in the, who's one of the side characters, he's the kid who walks in on them in the room. He ends up getting stuck in a time loop and they kind of pull in this stuff with parallel dimensions. So yeah, it's at a time it swerves way closer to Back to the Future than it does to like Prom Night or Friday the 13th or something like that. But it still has that horror element. It still has the slasher element, although that is less original. That they just kind of keep that in there because that was in the original movie. It just is almost like, well, okay, we'll play lip service to that. But again, like I said, I don't care about that. I'm fine with that because I'm kind of such a fan of the genre that this kind of mixed two genres and it did it as well as you're going to get. I'm a huge fan of the mixture of horror and science fiction. You get that in movies like Alien or Event Horizon or The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing. These are three movies that I've always held up as some of my favorite sci-fi horror movies, or even like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is a contemporary, well, at least 1978 or 1956, whenever it's made. They're all contemporary movies. But I like the cross-genre works of those two. And because it's already dealing with a time loop, just throwing in that explanation gives it more sci-fi feel to it. But it's still whimsical and fun. And if you like that first one, the characters are all there and they're preserved enough that they're not doing stupid things. Like I mentioned Back to the Future, suddenly they're not falling apart when somebody calls them chicken. It has a pragmatic explanation and it does tie a lot of it into the first movie. So if you like the first one, you should like this one. It's a nice little spinoff. I don't know how many more of these you can do before it really starts to circle the drain. But for right now, thumbs up on that sequel. I'm going to have to say that Happy Death Day to You kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the next film, which is Isn't It Romantic? Rebel Wilson plays a cynical woman who finds herself stuck in a romantic comedy.
Natalie's saying that romantic comedies are bad.
All those movies are lies that are terrible pop songs.
I think people would have an easier time seeing you if you were a little more open.
I think I might be going crazy.
I hit my head really hard and I woke up in this alternate universe and guys look at me in the eyes.
I think I'm trapped in a... My life's become a... Romantic comedy! PG-13!
I've always liked Rebel Wilson, even in movies that I don't particularly like. Like, I was not a fan of Bridesmaids, and I know a lot of people like that, but I didn't like Bridesmaids, but I thought she was funny in that. Anytime she shows up in a movie, I think she's one of the best parts of it. I always thought she was great as Fat Amy in the Pitch Perfect movies. I think they never gave her enough to do. Finally, in the third one they did, but that was kind of a garbage movie anyways. And I'd like to see her get her own starring role. I mean, my God, if you can give Amy Schumer two or three movies, we can give Rebel Wilson a couple big movies where she can headline and wrap it around herself. And I think she's hilarious. I think she does a great job in these movies. I just wish I had a chance to see this one. They didn't screen it, which was kind of distressful because I wish they would have. First of all, I like romantic comedies. I'm one of those guys who think a good romantic comedy can be a lot of fun. Like a crappy one's terrible, but you can say that about almost any movie, except for like crappy horror and crappy sci-fi can be fun on a cheesy standpoint. But I like a good little rom-com and I understand the universe that they exhibit. Now, I mean, I don't want them as cheesy and as goofy as like the Hallmark Christmas movies. But yeah, I mean, give me the 90s collection with Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock and Reese Witherspoon, and I'm there. I'm okay with that kind of stuff. So Isn't It Romantic? It looks like it could be a lot of fun. It looks like it could be very, very cute. I'm glad to see Rebel Wilson finally get in a movie where it's her spotlight and doesn't have to share that with anybody else. I mean, yeah, Liam Hemsworth is in this. Really, who cares about Liam Hemsworth aside from Miley Cyrus? I mean, he's not the person, when you say Hemsworth, that's not the first one you think of. But Rebel Wilson, it's good to see her getting her starring role. It's good to see her getting a movie that can focus on her. I just hope that they give her a couple more and let her diversify and do some different things and let her branch out from the character of Fat Amy in the Pitch Perfect movies. Cause you can't just throw a bunch of heavy jokes at somebody. I know for myself. I mean, yeah, I have a show called Fat Guys in the Movies and I joke about it. But it's okay to not focus on that on every single thing you do. So yeah, I'd like to see more stuff with Rebel Wilson, even sight unseen, even though this movie's going to have to get a bad rating for not being screened. I'm a fan of Rebel Wilson. I'd like to see her succeed. But still, I'm going to have to say, Isn't It Romantic? Gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Alita Battle Angel, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Plague of the Dead. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews with Alita Battle Angel. A cyborg discovers her true identity in a distant dystopian future.
Doc found you in the scrapyard. So you must be from up there.
And I'm just an insignificant girl.
Yeah, that's what they want you to think.
I'm not your daughter. I don't know what I am.
I do. You're the most advanced weapon ever.
I do not stand by. In the presence of evil,
She is threatening the natural order of things.
Okay, now, I've never read the original manga that this is based on. I don't know how close it is. It's sort of like when Death Note came out on Netflix. There are all these people complaining because it wasn't like the original manga. But, you know, most people in America actually haven't read the mangas. So it's fine to have a fandom for that, but realize they're not making it for the manga audience because the manga audience is very, very small. So I went in this movie completely ignorant of what the original source material was like. I'm only speaking on this as the movie I saw. Now, this was one that had some screenings. It didn't screen in Columbus, but they ended up doing a fan event like earlier in the week where you could buy a special ticket and you got to go see it in IMAX 3D. And they had like behind the scenes, like they had a Q&A afterwards. Like it was pre-recorded, but they put that up on the screen afterwards. I ended up leaving during the Q&A because it was kind of softball, goofy questions that were all very tailored to what the actors and filmmakers were trying to, you know, promote in the movie. The film itself, as I understand, James Cameron's been wanting to make a movie of this for almost 20 years, and he ended up not directing it himself, but working with Robert Rodriguez as the director. And, I mean, the big thing that they talk about in the behind the scenes and anything you read about this is the technology of it. And they're right. The uncanny valley doesn't exist so much with the Alita character. And that's important because you have that character interacting with regular human actors in the same frame. Now, it's not quite destroying the uncanny valley because Alita herself is sort of hyper real. They make her look a little bit more, stylized. She's got those big eyes and that pulls it out of the uncanny valley. The reason the uncanny valley exists is because the closer you get to human correctness, the weirder it looks, and that's where the valley dips down. Well, they just pulled it out of that valley a little bit. They kind of made her into this anime character, which is a little more appealing to the eye because it looks a little more cartoonish. Now, I'll tell you, the animation and the technology is fantastic in this movie. And they talk about all the advancements they made in it and how good it is. And yes, the 3D looks really good. There's parts where they're like climbing on this thing to go up to this city in the sky. And you look down and it kind of has that same feeling that I had when I watched The Walk in 3D on IMAX. I mean, you sort of get that pit in your stomach, you feel that vertigo and that nerves of being up high in that illusion. So yeah, I mean, from a technical standpoint, it's a beautiful looking movie and they have stuff that really is kind of eye popping. With that said, as good as the movie is, your movie's only as good as its script. And I hate to tell you that this script is kind of bad. That is not a judgment against the original manga. Remember, I've never read it. I don't even know how close this is to the original manga. I'm judging this solely on watching it as a film. And I'm sorry, but the script's bad. It has some of the most dead flat lines in it. It has weirdly contrived moments. They're just such corny lines. And you sit there and be like, oh, I can see why this is directed by the guy who directed The Adventures of Shark Boy and Lava Girl. Both Cameron and Rodriguez love their technology and they're both very good at it. But in terms of putting together a coherent character and directing actors, the acting, you have three Oscar winners in this movie. You have Mahershala Ali, you have Jennifer Connelly, and you have Christoph Waltz, who's I think won it twice. And none of them can act at all in this movie. I mean, the computer-generated actors are better than the actual actors in this movie, and they're like Oscar winners. Then there's like weird things like in the background. It takes like place like 500 years in the future. And they're sort of in this marketplace where you have all these different people from all these different cultures. And there was like a guy in like a Hawaiian shirt and regular khaki shorts and Birkenstocks. And I'm like, really? Did you just put out a casting call for extras and say, whatever you got in your closet, put on and come on in as long as it doesn't have a logo on it? For as much money as they sunk into the technology, they could have sunk a little bit into the costume design. Also, it's sort of like the Mortal Instruments, if you remember that movie from December, which few people do. That was a movie where like, oh, well, this is what happened. There was this big war and the battle between these cities. And I'm like, that's the movie I want to see. I want to see about the cities and the fighting and the downfall of civilization and these Martian attack robots and everything. I kind of want to see that movie. No. We're just going to do Rollerball. It basically turns into a Rollerball remake at a certain point. And I'm sorry. I wanted to like this one. But I didn't. So I'm going to have to say Alita Battle Angel kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office. Last week was a huge surprise, and that surprise was the Lego Movie did not do well. It did only $34 million for the weekend, which, you know, some people might think that's okay, but that's almost half of what the first movie made. It's opening weekend. And even What Women Want kind of came in underperforming, under 20. It's still going to make its money. Cold Pursuit was about what they were expecting. It was a bad weekend for movies. And the Lego Movie, I don't know what caused the Lego Movie to collapse like it did. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it's not a franchise. It was a one-shot movie that was clever and fun, and then they tried to force a sequel on it. And the Batman Lego Movie was good, but then when they had the Lego Ninjago Movie, I think you had diminishing returns, and people are like, well, we've seen this three times before, even though I only went and saw the first one. The Lego Movie could win again this weekend with, like, $20 million, because I don't think Alita's going to do terribly well. And then, of course, Happy Death Day has a limited market, as does Incident Romantic. And with those movies opening a little earlier in the week, they're going to suck up some of the air out of the room and lose their Valentine's Day crowds to the week. And then the box office over the weekend is going to be kind of weak. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I want to talk about this week, The Plague of the Zombies, which is new from Shout Factory, Scream Factory. Well, I mean, kind of new. This one, I apologize. This thing got misplaced in my stack of DVDs. It ended up under a bunch of award screeners, and it came out in January. But it's something worth talking about because it's a great little movie. The Plague of the Zombies. Let's just play the trailer. A doctor travels to a remote village only to discover that someone is practicing voodoo to raise the dead as slaves.
This coach is bound for a terrifying destination. Dead. But no corpse can remain at peace in this village of the undead, this land of the zombies.
Young Martinus also says that he saw something on the moors, something that he insists was his brother.
Someone in this village is practicing witchcraft. That corpse wandering on the moors is an undead, a zombie.
This is from Hammer Films, which, if you don't know who Hammer Films is, they're a British company, and they kind of became known in the middle to end of the 20th century as basically the British version of Universal, where they did a whole bunch of these horror movies, stuff like The Horror of Dracula and Frankenstein and The Curse of the Mummy, and they had their own werewolf movie. Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing showed up in a ton of those movies. And they're great sort of British films from the 50s and 60s. Now, The Plague of the Zombies was made, I think, in 1966. It takes place in the 1860s. So they all had this gothic horror feel to it. And this one actually is a relatively fun, coherent movie. It's also a different type of zombie, because prior to 1968, when George Romero did Night of the Living Dead, zombies were people brought back to life to become slaves. Only after 1968 and the Night of the Living Dead did they become ghouls that ate the flesh of the living. So this is about a guy who is bringing back all the dead from the graveyard to help his insane plan and to be slave labor for him. But it's a neat little movie, and mainly because you got to put yourself in the context of the time it came out. In the 1960s in England, you didn't have a lot of this stuff in the multiplex where they're talking about dead raising for life. You've got decapitations in the movie. You got grim stuff happening. And yeah, they use red paint, blood, and there's not a whole lot of gore, and the makeup effects are kind of goofy because, like I said, that was, what, 50 years ago. But it's kind of a neat little movie. It's kind of breezy. It goes through in an hour and a half. And, you know, I mean, there's some corny acting. There's some cheesy moments. There's a scene where somebody gets stabbed in the shoulder and immediately dies because apparently there's a vital organ somewhere in there. So it does have that cheesiness of its time, but it's a fun little movie. And there's some great little special features on it. You've got two new audio commentaries and a look back at the world of Hammer and Raising the Dead, which is a making of the film. There's also a discussion about the restoration of the film because the print looks fantastic. So it's more than just a movie. So you have a little bit more entertainment value out of it than just the 90 minutes it takes to watch it. But it's a great one for a horror movie fan to put on your shelves and keep your other horror movies company. The Plague of the Zombies on Blu-ray totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That is it for this week. I need to go. And when I come back next week, I'm going to talk about How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. Happy Valentine's Day weekend, everybody. Stay safe and stay happy. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.